Hey, remember how we were going to talk about the N64 for the 64th episode?
Oh, yeah!
Well, we're about to record episode 65.
Oh, son of a... Welcome to the Bumblecast. I'm your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and joining me as always in that beautiful 64-bit resolution, Kyle Krause.
I'm very blocky, and my textures are very blurry, and there's a lot of fog all around me. It's great.
But you're so charming and endearing.
I know. It's awesome. It's glorious. And I'm like weirdly shaped with like three handles. And there's like an extraneous D-pad over to my left side for no reason. And then also another shoulder button over there that's like hardly ever used in anything. But it's there, you know, just in case.
We'll get back to that topic in just a second. But otherwise, how have you been, sir?
Oh, I'm doing all right. You know, I'm hanging in there. Not a whole heck of a lot going on other than the fact that... By the time this goes up, I will have celebrated the 15th anniversary of KNGI and my other show, Nitro Game Injection, so that's pretty cool.
Woo-hoo!
That's pretty cool, I suppose.
That's super cool.
15 crazy years doing this thing. I don't even know what I'm doing. Why am I still doing it? Ian, why am I still doing this?
Because you love it. You do it for the people.
I do actually like doing it. I mean, that can really be the only explanation. Either I'm crazy or I like doing it. Or maybe it's both. Or maybe
you
one.
You may be right. You may be crazy.
Maybe.
And that's 15 years of you doing KNGI.
Maybe it's both or one causes the other. I don't know. So how
it
are you
may
doing?
Be both. One causes the other. So listen to Kyle on the 15th anniversary KGI. That's growing. Oh well.
You did it. You did it. It's perfect. I didn't hear any problems there at all.
I missed a crucial letter.
Yeah, whatever. You don't need it. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, I am plum tuckered out.
And you're gearing up for some busy times.
I am. By the time this goes up, I want to give a shout out to all the wonderful folks who came out to Toronto Comic Con. We're recording this before the show because I won't have time to do it after the show, or during the show, rather. So I hope it goes well.
There could be maybe
thank you to everyone who came out.
Maybe nobody showed up. You never know. No, there will be
people. No. There are at least two people who are going to show up. One of them who actually said on Twitter that they were going to skip the show until I said, surprise, I'm coming. So,
there will be people there. I was just, you know, just thinking like, oh, man, wouldn't it be hilarious if, like, nobody showed up? Oh, man.
I would cry to myself.
Not show up to see you, just like not show up at all. Like it's just an empty Comic-Con. That actually sounds pretty good. I'd like an empty Comic-Con sometimes, because I've been to Comic-Con when it's the exact opposite of empty, and it's a little harrowing.
Also, coming up the weekend of this episode is WonderCon out in Anaheim, California. Mm. I'm being flown out there by IDW. We're going to be promoting this obscure indie book called Sonic the Hedgehog. I've got multiple signings and multiple panels lined up. So if you haven't already, go to bumbleking.com, head over to the Bumble calendar. You'll see the exhaustive lineup for that. And once I'm back and have entered into the Odin sleep and returned renewed, Kyle and I have got to sit down and figure out getting our commentaries and the long-promised patron meetup figured out. We are so sorry, guys. It's just between my schedule and Kyle's work schedule, it hasn't been working.
Yeah, we're sorry. It's been tough to kind of get in there, but we'll work it out. We'll work it out. We'll get there. We'll get there. Also, I was asked by I forget who asked me. I saw this earlier. Someone asked me what it would take to get me out to WonderCon, and the first thing would be tickets because I think they're all gone. I know Saturday's sold out at least.
I might be able to wrangle you a guest pass.
The other thing is that I mean it's not that far away from me, but I don't know how much time. I don't know how much time I could wrangle in there. I don't know. I could figure something out, but I don't know. It's a
Now,
pretty
how long is
long.
the trip? Is it to and from?
It's like a 6-hour drive.
Oh, to Anaheim?
Yes.
No, dude, because unless you have like magical lodgings already secured, that'd be a 12-hour round trip.
Well, I mean, it's worth it. Sometimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not encourage Kyle to kill himself. I need him.
I like driving. I'm fine with driving.
Well, we've established this if you watch Bumblecast Gaming and American Truck Simulator, shameless plug number one.
I mean, it's fine. It's fine. I don't have a problem with it. It would probably be like an over, at least like an overnight or like a 2-day thing. But yeah, my, I don't know if my schedule will kind of allow for that right now. But I would love to. I'd love to, but I don't know if it's in the cards. So it's all good though. You can
We'll figure something out one day.
go there and see Ian, because that's why you're all there anyway. Everyone's there to see Ian.
Point and laugh at the jet laggy zombie.
Everyone is there to see Ian. They just don't know it yet. All right. Shall we move on into our Bumble raffle?
I do believe so. The Bumble Raffle is a contest we have every episode where you, the lovely listener, can win a prize. Now, if you want to enter into the Bumble Raffle, just email us at bumblecast@yahoo.com with the subject line Bumble Raffle. Everybody who enters has the same chance. The only difference is that our patrons over at patreon.com/bumblecast are entered automatically into every single drawing. Everyone has the same chance, but if you're not a patron, you just have to email us for every show. So this episode's winner is
Justin S.
Congratulations, Justin. We will reach out to you and let you know what your options are in terms of prizes. We mentioned this last episode. If you were one of the folks who got one of the Comixology codes and it didn't work, whoopsies, we didn't know that they were bugged or whatever, and there's no way to fix it. So please email us at Bumblecast@yahoo.com, say my prize didn't work, and we will figure that out. If we haven't contacted you yet, because we have been busy and forgetful, and it happens, email us saying, dudes, you owe me a prize. We'll figure it out. We will get you set up. With all that aside, let's move on to the main topic, which we kind of missed the boat on because I really had to rant about Star Wars, apparently.
Yeah, and I completely like just jettisoned that out of my head until we were actually recording the show, and I was like, oh yeah, we were gonna do that because it would have been, good reason to do it. But whatever, it's fine.
But we're talking about that iconic video game console, the Nintendo 64. The one that made the grand leap into true three-dimensional gaming.
Oh, come on, you can't say that.
What?
Star Fox doesn't count?
No, you're basically moving on a flat plane.
You don't.
Yes, everything's rendered three-dimensionally, but.
What about the 3D racing game Stunt Race FX for the Super NES that I might be like the only person who's actually a fan of that game?
Like I said, the only true three.
You can drive. You can turn around and drive in reverse. You can drive the wrong way, so it's not like you're on rails necessarily. Although there are walls and you can't go past them. But hey, come on, we'll ignore that.
I'm sure someone will be quick to point out that all the racers in Mario Kart were flat sprites in a 3D environment, but
Oh,
never
no,
mind
no,
on that.
no,
We're talking
no,
about
no,
the
no, no,
N64.
no, no, no. Mario Kart, Super Mario Kart is not a 3D environment, technically.
Excuse me, I meant Mario Kart 64.
Mario Kart 64, well, that's N64. That's where we're at now. That's what we're talking about. So, but if we're talking about Super Mario Kart, it's like, no, that's not quite 3D. That's just that's just a flat background plane rotating around a character. It's a really good facsimile of 3D, but it is not 3D.
Did you or did you not have an N64 of your own?
Man, I probably got it on like launch, well, not launch day, but the launch year, Christmas. Nice. If I remember correctly, I was pretty much the N64 kid. You know, the old the kid unwrapping the N64 on Christmas Day. The video of that's been around for decades at this point. I was pretty much that, just without a video camera. So I think I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure like that was me. And that was probably a lot of kids on the day they opened up their N64s on Christmas in 96. So, yeah, I like Mario Kart or Mario 64 and Nintendo 64 on Christmas Day of the same launch year. So that was my that was when I was introduced to it. Although, actually, you know what? I was first introduced to it technically in a kiosk at Blockbuster Video.
Oh, yeah.
They set up a kiosk with both Pilot Wings and Mario 64, and you could play either one. And my tiny little mind was exploding just seeing Mario running around in 3D. It was like,
Pilot Wings 64 was a comfy game.
It was like, whoa, it's Mario, but he can go everywhere. So that was my experience with it. What about you?
I'm pretty sure we got ours Christmas as well. That was the second major console for the household.
Uh-huh.
Our Genesis was the first one. I'm not counting the Atari.
Why not?
Because we never got to play it. Apparently it was too hard to hook up or something. I think that was just the excuse my parents gave me, so that, I wouldn't be playing it nonstop.
Your parents were kidding around with you. The Atari's like the most simple system in the world.
Well, we had a very, very large, heavy TV. Of course, I guess everyone did at that time.
Yeah.
But moving it around to plug it in was the problem, I guess. I don't know. It's the second major console that we all got to play.
Okay.
Mario 64 was kind of the grand quest of me, my younger brother, and my father. And I don't know how many years it took us to get all 120 stars, but I do remember on Bomb Battlefield, I actually had to go to bed early with a tension headache because I couldn't handle all those three dimensions.
Oh,
trying to hit that dump and release the chain chomp, I couldn't do it. I could not aim it to save my life, and I just collapsed. I couldn't do it. I couldn't handle it. It was too much.
Too many 3Ds. Too many polygons. Too many sharp edges on those polygons.
I think it was the first console where I bought a video game for myself on a whim. I had some money. I went into the Toys R Us, may it rest in peace, and I knew I wanted to buy a game because this is the first time I was going to buy a game with my money. What do you buy for the N64? I didn't have any of the gaming magazines. Oh, this one looks kind of cool. There's spaceships. And it even comes with a rumble pack. I didn't know that you had such a thing. But if I'm getting free hardware upgrade with it, why not?
Yeah.
And that is how my sad, sad addiction with Star Fox began.
Oh, man. I was already a big fan of the original Star Fox when Star Fox 64 came out. So I was like, oh, yeah, I'm Star Fox 64. I'm in, man. I'm in 100%. And yeah, it's a great game. Arguably the last great Star Fox game. What's that?
Just descending through the atmosphere, coming in low over Cornarian Bay. The way that the water rippled and affected you flying low enough just blew my mind.
Yeah. It's still a surprisingly good-looking game. For even though the N64 has not aged super gracefully, I think Star Fox 64...
No!
I think Star Fox 64 is probably still one of the better-looking games. So.
I am a little sad that when it came to Virtual Console on the Wii,
mm-hmm.
it was slightly bugged so that it didn't run at the proper speed. It was running, I think, a full 60 frames per second. So, holy crap, dude, you are flying through that game. It's like, this is as fast as I remember it. And then they patched going up. Nope, we fixed it. It's how it's supposed to play. And it's like, oh, this isn't nearly as fast as I remember it going.
Nope. Yeah. Yeah. The emulation on the Wii for the N64 was kind of impressive considering the specs of the Wii, but at the same time, it wasn't very good.
And of course, we played Mario Kart.
Oh, yeah.
Day in, day out, explored every... We would lose races all the time because we just explored the level.
Oh, yeah.
Holy mackerel, there's Princess Peach's castle, and can I get to the green swamp? What is the meaning behind the green swamp? Kyle, tell me, what secrets does it hold?
It holds the secret to life, the universe, and everything.
Of course. Maybe it's just decorative.
Either way, though, yeah, the Peach's castle on Peach Raceway was like one of those like weird moments where it's like, oh, so that's what's outside of the area in Mario 64.
Climb the hill in Mario 64, but now we know.
Yeah, now we know what's out there. It's a friggin' racetrack. This is awesome. I unfortunately do not think that became official canon, which is very disappointing.
Oh,
and the really disappointing thing, too, is when they brought that track back for Mario Kart 8, they closed off the area. You can't get over there.
Yeah, that was disappointing.
That was really disappointing. I'm like, oh, yeah, Peach's Castle in HD. Yeah, let's go check it out. Nope. Womp, womp. So that's
we also laughed way too much when we finally unlocked mirror mode and went backwards through Toad's Turnpike.
Oh.
And just driving through oncoming traffic. Wham! 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 This is so much fun. Nobody's winning. Wham!
Oh, boy. Oh, man. I remember having a lot of multiplayer experiences with the N64, even being an only child. So that was always kind of cool. It was a really good social system. Like GoldenEye was a ton of fun to play four players.
Oh, absolutely.
I remember we had I was in middle school at the time, in like seventh grade, and we had a pretty young teacher. He was like in his early to mid 20s, I'd say. And he had a Nintendo 64, and it was like one of the last days of school. Both 7th and 8th grade, he would bring in his N64, and we'd all sit around and play GoldenEye, four players.
Nice.
Just rotating controllers through, and that was awesome. That was tons of fun. You know, I don't know if that would happen these days, but it was a good time. It was a good time back then, you know? It was a more innocent time.
That game had the best cheat codes.
Oh, you know? It was full of them. Yeah, it had some really awesome cheat codes and some hilarious ones.
I mean, some of them are notoriously difficult to unlock, but that was part of the fun.
Exactly.
You know, you get the best toys for doing the best job.
Or you just get a Game Shark. And then just hack everything. You just hack the games to pieces. I had some fun with the Game Shark, I'll be honest with you. You could do all sorts of things to games that were like just crazy stuff, like being able to moon jump in Mario 64 and stuff. Just jump up onto that island in Bob-omb Battlefield instead of cannoning up there. It's great.
And of course, that platforming icon of the time, Banjo-Kazooie. Man, I love those games. I got burned out on Banjo-Tooie just because it got so big. And it's like, okay, which one of these area-specific moves do I have to do this one time to get the thing? And then Rare was like, oh, is that too much for you, little Bobby? Here, have Donkey Kong 64.
See, I've never played Donkey Kong 64, and I've never played Banjo-Tooie, but I've played Banjo-Kazooie. I think I beat Banjo-Kazooie. I know it got really far, and I had fun with that game. I don't know if I would necessarily go back to it over Mario 64, even if it is like more refined and polished, and because it was a little bit of a later release, and it's Rare. It's still good, but I don't know if I could go back to it over Mario 64 necessarily. Like, if given the choice between playing the two, I'd be like, I like Banjo-Kazooie. It's a fun game. it's a good game. It's like, oh, it's not Mario 64. Mario 64, like, changed the industry and was also a really awesome, fun, well-made game, so.
It was. And it had a fantastic soundtrack. Not to knock Banjo-Kazooie's, because it's fun, but Mario 64's soundtrack is one of the best in the franchise, I would dare say.
Yeah, I would agree there. Koji Kondo is kind of a musical genius. That's kind of how he rolls. Grant Kirkhope, also a musical genius in his own right. But, you know, he's a bit of a different style from Koji Kondo, so. Let's see, what else? Oh, other great games on the N64, Blast Corps. That's a good one. I don't know if
you never got to play too much of that one.
Oh, man, that's like one of my favorite games on the N64, and I think it's also one of the most overlooked good games. You know, you destroy everything. I don't know if this was like, this seems like a theme of that time in gaming where destruction was common. I don't know. It doesn't seem like we really get a whole heck of a lot of that anymore. Even in like first person shooters and stuff, you don't really, you know, just go out of your way to necessarily destroy things. You're just kind of killing, shooting people. You don't really, you know, blow up too much stuff in a lot of modern games, which is disappointing. That's all I really want to do is just make things explode. I mean, is that too much to ask, Ian?
No, it really isn't. It should be your right to make polygonal things explode into smaller polygonal things.
That's all I want in life, and that's what Blast Corps provides to me.
You know what I had completely forgotten until just now?
What's that?
I played StarCraft on the N64.
Was that on the N64? I don't even remember that being on the N64.
It worked about as well as you can imagine.
Never, I'm guessing not very well. Could you read the text?
I don't think so.
Barely, maybe, if you squinted really hard.
I want to say it ran slowly, and I want to say the full campaign wasn't on there because they couldn't make it fit or something.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Plus, trying to mini-max all of your units with an N64 controller?
No, that's not the
now
kind of
that
game.
Controller.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about
for
the
heart. Longest time, we held it with the left tine and the right tine, and we reached across that metal stick just so we have both bumpers. It wasn't until somebody pointed out that you're supposed to hold it in the middle that we're like, no, why would they make you leave off an entire side of the controller? Oh, wait, this works a whole lot better.
Yeah, I don't remember if I, like, figured it out on my own or if someone had to tell me. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, I always thought that was really weird. But, I mean, most of the games just never used the D-pad. Like, they had no function or minimal function, like, you know, changing views in a racing game with the D-pad, that was a pretty common thing. Yeah. And that's like something you don't really ever have to do very often, so it was just kind of shoved off to the side. The L button I don't think was used all too often. It might have been used in Mischief Makers, because I think Mischief Makers was one of the few games where you actually were, I don't remember if you were forced to play it with the D-pad or you could play it with the D-pad, but it was a, you know, 2D side-scroller, so it made sense. I think there just weren't a lot of 2D side-scrollers on the N64, so like hardly any of them would take advantage of the D-pad.
Tying into last episode, one of the best on the N64 was Rogue Squadron.
Yes.
That's a really good one. Man, they hit gold on that one. The sequels were okay, but it felt like they were trying to reinvent the wheel.
I think
the first game was just perfect.
I think Rogue Squadron 2 is the technically better game, but I have a lot more affinity for the original. It's a good game. It's a really good game. Also in that same vein, the only good thing to come out of Episode 1, Star Wars Episode 1 Racer for the N64.
Yeah. You know about the dual controller trick?
Which one's that? Oh,
the one where you plug in the controller to port 1 and port 3, and you can control each engine individually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was like, I think they kind of like based that on the controls for the arcade game, because it was also an arcade game at the time.
Right.
So, yeah, that was really fun, actually, to do that. It made it a lot harder, though.
Yeah, that was part of the fun.
Exactly. I'm trying to think what else. Oh, I remember in Rogue Squadron, like all of the secret ships you could unlock, or all the codes. Speaking of games with a lot of cheat codes, Rogue Squadron is full of them, and they're awesome. Like being able to play as a TIE fighter, or no, TIE interceptor. Sorry, not a TIE fighter. Who'd want to play as that? You want to play as a TIE interceptor. That's what you want.
The car.
Oh yeah. And then
what was it, a Buick?
I think so. Yeah, something like that. And also the Millennium Falcon, of course. Which yeah, it's yeah. kind of funny because the camera like will pan past the Millennium Falcon on the dock when you're selecting your ship, and you're like, oh man, I want to play as the Millennium Falcon. And then there's a code for it. It's like, yes.
No, they knew what they were doing.
And then, of course you're going to unlock the Naboo Starfighter, which is actually a pretty good fighter in its own right. So
yeah, it, overpowered even.
Yeah. Just a tad, but I always preferred the TIE Interceptor. It's like, oh, cool. I get to play as the TIE Interceptor. I mean, it was weak. The shields were weak. You get like one shot out of the sky, yeah. but the cannons were pretty powerful. So that was a fun game.
Also, Shadows of the Empire, I think is one of the very few extended universe books of the time to get any kind of media recognition.
Right.
Hilariously, it is completely inaccurate to the book, but whatever.
And it's also completely non-canonical now, both the book and the and the game. But
that one,
it was neat.
It had the best cheat code.
Oh yeah, it had good. I think it had some pretty good codes.
You had to hold down every single button on the controller and move the joystick left and right, not fully. Just incrementally, back and forth like 5 times. I think I ended up doing it with my tongue because everything else had to be held down. But it unlocked everything. You could adjust the color sliders. You could play as enemy units.
Oh, yeah. I remember
that. Level skip, it lets you adjust every single variable. Gravity, health, ammo, what weapons you had. Oh, man, it gave you everything. It was the ultimate debug code.
I remember most of the things I remember about Shadows of the Empire was that the on foot sections were clunky and probably nearly unplayable today. But the vehicle sections were really good, and I think I think that's where Rogue Squadron was just like, we're just gonna do all space battles or all. All vehicle battles. We're not going to even bother with the on-foot stuff. Who cares? So, yeah.
I distinctly remember, or am I thinking of the GameCube version, where you're doing the second Death Star battle, the Battle of Endor, and you turn on the targeting computer and you see just this swarm of TIE fighters coming for you. It's like, eep!
I don't remember if that was in the N64 version.
That might have been the GameCube version, because that might have been college, so never mind me.
Yeah. I do like the notable battle recreations in Rogue Squadron. And also the Battle of Hoth is kind of legendary in Shadows of the Empire, so.
Mm.
Let's see, what other great games were there that I can mention off the top of my head? Oh, man. There were a lot of great games for the N64. Like arcade ports. There were quite a few arcade ports. I remember Cruisin' USA, the racing game that came out in the arcades in like 1994 or 93 or something. It had on the attract mode, it had like a splash screen advertising the Nintendo Ultra 64. It says like coming 1995 to the Nintendo Ultra 64. And well, of course, it came out as the N64 and it didn't come out till 96. So, but they kind of like snuck that in there as a little tease. Like, yeah, it's going to come home eventually. I think Killer Instinct also had that. It might have been like Killer Instinct 2 or something that had that.
Oh wow!
Speaking of good games, Killer Instinct for N64.
Man, do you want to feel old? Go and look up the old renders of the characters.
And
back in the day, that was slick. That was like, holy mackerel,
man!
They can actually do that on a home console.
They look almost real.
Look at it, and it's like, ooh, that's your nice first run on a toaster there, buddy, but why don't you let it bake for another couple years?
Oh, yeah. Poor Orchid. She does not.
Just thinking that.
She does not fare well with with the passage of time for N64 era. Looks fine now in the new Mortal Kombat. In the new Killer Instinct. It's not Mortal Kombat. Please, Killer Instinct fans, don't crucify me for calling it Mortal Kombat. I am sorry.
Was it Turok that debuted on the N64?
Yeah. I want to say it was like near simultaneous PC and N64. So, yeah.
Okay. Never got to play that one, but... it's kind of one of those games.
So when you hear about pretty frequently, especially if you're talking like third-party N64 games, which there weren't many, which, you know, is kind of a trend with Nintendo. There weren't nearly as many.
Kirby 64!
Oh, yeah!
How could I forget? Oh, such a lovely game.
That's a very fun game. Also, Bomberman... go ahead.
One of the best final boss tracks, period. Yeah, straight up.
02, right?
Yeah.
Fight. That's a really freaking good track. Also, another good game with a cutesy lead character would be Bomberman 64. And there's also Yoshi's Story, which as a follow-up to Yoshi's Island, a little disappointing, but I think on its own, it's a fine enough game.
And visually, as distinctive as it was, I think that one's aged actually pretty well compared to a lot of other N64 games.
Yeah, Yoshi's Story actually still looks pretty decent. It's not bad. I would agree with that. It's a very simple game. It's like, yeah, there really isn't a whole heck of a lot to it. So if you're really thinking like, oh yeah, it's like the sequel to Yoshi's Island, it's like, well, it doesn't really quite hold up to the level of Yoshi's Island, but it's still a fun game in its own right.
Mario Party debuted on the N64.
Indeed.
And ruining friendships since 1996.
Yeah, and also ruining controllers and the palm of your hands since 97, 96, whenever it came out.
Oh, you just made me remember. Pokemon Coliseum, or what was it called? What was the
Stadium?
N64? Stadium, yeah. Never mind playing in 3D. Forget that noise. The first game's mini games were the best. The one where you had to hit the button to make your Magikarp flop high enough to hit the counter button. And every time you hit that button, you go, Corp! 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 We would be crying. We were laughing so hard. We just, didn't matter who won, we just kept hammering the button. Corp! 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 Corp!
Poor Magikarp.
Oh, man, that was funny.
Poor Magikarp.
Or the one where you're the Lickitung is trying to eat the sushi, but if you accidentally grab the plate of wasabi, they just flail around going, Mah!
What about Pokemon Snap? It's like the only Pokemon game I really, like, truly know, I think. And I haven't even played it.
Criminal. It didn't get a sequel on the Wii U.
I think, it would have been perfect for the Wii U. But, you know, I don't know. It's a silly game. It's charming. It's charming.
It is.
It truly is. That's the N64 in a nutshell, really. It's just a charming system. It was very early, kind of primitive in a way. But, you know, it opened the imagination.
It absolutely did.
And brought a lot of firsts to consoles and to gaming in particular, like four-player local multiplayer that was actually built into the system, so like developers could actually take advantage of it and wanted to take advantage of it. I think that changed the game for a lot of things, like for big gaming parties and stuff. Having four controllers was just a really big deal. So
that was the system where I first got the scope of the worlds could be infinite. You know, obviously they couldn't be. You ran high enough, you would see where the end of the textures were.
Right.
But you got that feeling of, what's over that horizon? I want to go exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anything after the N64 really captured that same level of, what is that, to me, until Breath of the Wild. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, I haven't played some of the other MMOs and massive RPGs like Skyrim and whatnot. But a lot of those, too, it felt like, I'm thinking like maybe Saints Row 2. Yeah, huge map, fun to explore, but it didn't really fill me with a sense of what goes beyond. It's, okay, let me scour this giant map and find all the little pieces. It felt like, here's the world, here's the map, I just have to find it all.
Right.
Back in the N64 era, it was, if I could just fly a little bit to the left in my R-Wing, or if my fuel gauge wouldn't run out in Pilot Wing 64, or if Mario could just jump a little bit higher, what would be over that ridge? What have I not seen yet?
Right.
And that's just a fun, fuzzy feeling that I had forgotten.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of wondering if that maybe also is, like, our age at the time the N64 came out. I don't know if it's kind of an age thing, but, I mean, you said you've also experienced that with Breath of the Wild, so it's not necessarily just an age thing, but...
I'm sure that's part of it.
I would agree. It was definitely one of those things that was, like, It's just a nice, it's a comforting system. That's really what it is. It's just a nice system.
It's about the only redeeming feature of Quest 64 is that sense of open world.
See, I never played that.
I'm just not like, much.
I know. It's like RPGs, eh. I still didn't even really know what an RPG was at that time, so. I was too busy. Well,
the system sure didn't give it to you.
No, not really. I was too busy playing racing games and platformers on the N64. Oh, and the awesome wrestling games. And I'm not joking about the wrestling games being awesome. The wrestling games are legitimately, like, freaking awesome and hilarious fun to play. Four players really helped with that, too, because you get four people in a ring and just beat each other senseless with chairs and baseball bats, and it's glorious.
Oh! How could we forget? Smash Brothers debuted on the N64.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. That was when Smash Brothers was just kind of a little baby crossover game. You know, not too many characters, only like, what, 12?
10?
8? No. I think you had like 8 to begin with, and then it opened up
to then 12. Yeah,
12, okay. Yeah. And the baby crossover game. It was the only acknowledgement that Samus ever got that she still existed during the N64 era. It's like, oh, geez, oh, no. We already see where this is going. Oh, boy. Poor Samus.
But that one has not aged too well in retrospect, especially visually.
It's rough. It's rough. But again, it's charming. It has its charm.
It is.
And it laid a good groundwork. It laid a great foundation for what has become the juggernaut of Smash Brothers.
Plus, it had a fantastic commercial.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Costume characters just frolicking around and then starting to beat each other senseless. Yeah, well, I mean, hey, it's a good advertisement for it. One last game I wanted to mention real quick, F-Zero X.
Oh, shoot, yeah.
That's like the only N64 game that was actually as fast as it could possibly be. That game.
It's still fast.
And yeah, well, that game is a solid 60 frames per second. And the only reason why it's a solid 60 frames per second is because everything is super freaking simple. Like, I think cars are made up of, like, 20 polygons at the most. And, like, there's hardly any textures. And, like, yeah, it's you look at it in screenshots, and it's not a good-looking game in the least. But at speed, at 60 FPS, at full speed, it screams by. And of course the soundtrack is legendary. I've heard several like YouTube remixers and YouTube guitarists who do video game music covers, and a lot of them point to like, oh yeah, F-Zero X was the point where I'm like, oh, video game music, it can rock. And yeah, F-Zero X is like freaking screaming guitars. It's like one of those things where it's like, it's 1996, so, okay, well, I think it came out in 97 or 98. No, I think it was 97. It was one of the earliest games where I got introduced to that kind of, that just screaming rock and metal just in your face. And, you know, it's one of the things that even, I think, influenced me and my musical tastes a bit. So yeah, I have to give a lot of credit to F-Zero X for that. And of course, it's just a really fun game. It's super fast, frantic, and it's, but you know, it keeps you on the edge of your seat, and that's why I love it. Also a great four player mode. And if four players at 60 frames per second, I don't even know how they pulled that off on this. I do know how they pulled it off. They put a ton of fog on the screen, but still. F-Zero X, man, that is a great game right there.
It really was a fantastic system.
It was. Yeah.
We could probably go on for another half hour. But
I think we've like built the games we'd put on like an N64 Classic Edition with this episode. So hey, there you go.
So we're going to move on. We actually have a bought ad space for this episode.
Indeed we do.
The Adventures of Tick-Tick is a monthly adults-only fantasy series following the adventures of a wizard kobold as she seeks to learn all that she can about the world of magic and love. Join her on her quest to learn all that she can as she runs into friends, enemies, and monsters in dramatic and romantic encounters. You can support Tick-Tick's Patreon and get such rewards as early access to the stories. And you can even become part of Tick-Tick's adventures by joining the Court of Dark Royals, who plot out the adventures for Tick-Tick and her friends. If you're interested in her adventures but don't or can't read the adult bits, check out Tick-Tick's site for updates and progress on the Safe for Work adventures of Tick-Tick. You can find her on patreon.com/TickTickKobold. For affinity.net/user/TickTickKobold or TickTickKobold.tumblr.com. That's TickTick.
All right. And I think it's time to go ahead and get into some Q&A action on this.
That's right. You've asked your questions on Twitter at Bumblecast or hashtag Bumblecast. You have emailed us at Bumblecast@yahoo.com. You've commented on the Patreon page at patreon.com/bumblecast, or you have left comments in the YouTube videos. You have thrown your questions at us. But first, we're going to get to the priority Q&A. If you want your questions answered sooner, head over to patreon.com/bumblecast, toss a couple bucks our way, and we will get to your questions before everybody else.
Indeed. And also, I should mention, if you are a patron and we haven't answered your questions yet, let me know. We get a lot of freaking questions now. It's like you're doing a new thing, Ian, that a lot of people are really interested in and want to check out. We're getting like inundated.
When the priority Q&A has a backlog, you know we're doing well.
Yeah. So if I've missed your question and we haven't answered it in like an episode or two or five or 10 or 20, let me know. Cause I'm not intentionally skipping you. It's just a, like, wow, we've gotten quite a few questions, so yeah, we're getting a ton. So thank you everybody for asking questions. It's just, whew, you're very active and excited, and that's good. So first priority Q&A question comes from a Fatoller. I think that's how you say that.
I would think so.
Fatoller? I don't know.
I like Fatoller.
Fatoller. In response to your reply to my question on Bumblecast 63, I wanted to ask how popular was Breezy and, by extension, any other Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog character in the eyes of Archie. I understand it's a nebulous region, especially with vocal fan bases, but how exactly do you gauge if something is popular or not? Is it purely sales and the number of mentions in correspondence?
It is not an exact science, but it is a bit of a gauge of see which issue kind of got a little bit of a bump and what kind of rumblings are online and what kind of fan mail we get or had gotten in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised by the very, very small but very, very angry contingent of hardcore Adventures of fans who hated any of the updates or redesigns to the characters. And I've tried to meet them part way and see their understanding. I really have. Because, you know, if you're a fan of something, if it goes too far off base, you're obviously going to be a little upset. But this is Adventures of. These characters didn't have a ton of depth. They basically had their shtick, their gimmick, their gag. And aside from Professor von Schlemmer, most of them didn't show up more than once.
Right.
Or if they did, they were in very small capacities.
Mm-hmm.
So taking these root ideas and fleshing them out into something more I thought was a good idea. Out of all the characters, I think Breezy probably, well, we didn't do a ton of them anyway, but I think Breezy really hit it off the most because she was such a strong character. And I hate that we never got around to the big reveal of who she actually was. But I'll get into that one day down the line when Lost Hedgehog Tales finally can come to light. But there were plans for Breezy, and I think folks would have ultimately liked her.
See, and I loved Breezy. It was just one of those things where I did not expect you to go back to that well at all.
She was rocking the red suit before Pauline, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Good point. I had to think about that for a second. I'm like, well, wait, wasn't she? No, not really. Because she wore like a pink dress in Donkey Kong. But anyway, yeah. I was like, holy crap, it's like Breezy from Adventures of is in here, and you're actually bringing her back, and she's a freaking great character. That was one of those moments where I'm like, yeah, Ian, you're kind of a genius.
Nah.
You kinda.
Not exactly.
Kinda, though. Next question comes from Mike B. Can we at least have both humans and quote-unquote Mobians on both worlds? Maybe find some way to infer that they are two different, closely connected worlds? I really enjoy the one inclusive world that we had in the post-reboot, and I hate to see the idea get ripped apart because of canon.
There was some fluff, we'll say, over confirming that the two worlds thing from the games is going to be the canon of the comics.
Yeah.
And I think folks are paying too much attention to the nitty-gritty. Because the two worlds thing has been around since Sonic Adventure. We just didn't know it. It wasn't confirmed until that one Q&A session, what, 5 years ago or so? And everyone was like, what? And it's like, oh, that's why Sonic X had the two worlds, because it was based off the Sonic canon. And really, it hasn't undermined any of the game stories at this point. Like, the story of T'Kal and Chaos really doesn't matter where it is. It's a strong enough story on its own right. You know, Shadow and his whole deal, it doesn't matter that it happens on the human world. His story is fairly standalone. Yeah, it raises some big questions. I'm not denying that. But it also isn't the brick through the window kind of distraction that I think a lot of people think it's going to be. So, I mean, obviously Sonic and his friends can cross over between the worlds, no problem with the games. If we get around to messing with that at all in the comic, probably going to follow suit. But again, the book isn't out yet.
Yeah.
The first year has been plotted. That's not a lot. Just relax. Let the stories come. You know, even if I had a bullet point list of all the super nerdy things I wanted to cover, there's no way to do that in a single year. So just let the comic be, you know? It's not really going to affect year one. Probably won't even affect year two. It's just, that's how it's been. That's how it has been for the past, oh, shoot, since 99. How many years is that? Almost 20 years. 18, good grief.
18. Yeah, well, actually, just about 20, if you want to say Sonic Adventure came out in 1998 in Japan. So, yeah.
It's not a big deal. It'll be fine. Trust me. I know what I'm doing. I've been doing this for a bit. Trust me. Trust me.
You've only rebooted and soft rebooted the series like 3 times at this point.
And I'll do it a fourth if I have to get this to work.
Eventually, I'll make it all work. Just cram it in there. Just... That's what I see now. You're just standing over like a I was gonna say a garbage can, but that's a really bad analogy. Yeah. maybe you're just like trying to pack your luggage for going on a trip, and you're just like cramming it in there. You got your foot down on it. You're trying your best to zip it up, and it's just like, come on.
I've done pre-reboot, post-reboot, IDW, Sonic X, and Sonic Boom continuities, and game continuities, considered Sega exclusive online thing. I've played with 6 different flavors of Sonic. I think I can manage.
I think you'll be fine. I think you'll be fine. I think it'll be okay. I don't know, though. It might be weird. It won't be weird. It'll be fine. Like, you probably won't even notice.
It's a giant talking blue hedgehog. It's weird enough. Let's move.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You guys are getting off into the weeds here a little bit. Whatever. And finally, from Scruffy Matt. Hi, Ian and Kyle. I was wondering.
Hi, Scruffy Matt.
I was wondering what your favorite custom character combinations are to use in Sonic Forces. Which character species and wispons do you prefer?
You go first.
I'd love to, but I have not played Sonic Forces, so I'm a little out of my depth with this question. Really.
Then I'll go first.
Yeah, you go ahead.
At last, and second. I think I might like the bird the best of all. Just in terms of, you know, mammalian characters make enough sense. The bird is the one I think that was really kind of off the beaten path. And granted, their model isn't all that different, but it's just neat, you know?
Yeah.
I liked throwing on the most hideous face possible, the most garish color combination possible. I loved that the variety of costumes, you could like straight up make a mecha character if you want.
Oh, yeah.
Or more or less make a lizard character if you have the right stuff put together. In terms of favorite wispons, I don't know. There's something innately satisfactory about the flamethrower. Just hold down the button and burn the.
I like, I mean, I could go like based on the aesthetics of the characters, at least. It kind of, I'm not really a big fan of the fact that there are like no hair options. I know that canonically none of the Sonic Sonic characters have hair. But, you know, it's just kind of weird. Yeah, I know. It's like, I know there's precedent set for it, but most of them don't seem to really have hair. So no hair options was kind of awkward to me. But, I don't know. They all kind of looked, it felt like they all kind of looked the same because they kind of did. There's some small variations. You know, you got a beak on the bird. That's pretty cool. A lot of it was ear changes, mainly.
And face changes.
There were some face changes, yeah. I think I like the look of the wolf, but I'm always kind of partial to wolves. So maybe that's it. I don't know. But I do love the extent of the costume. The costume options. There's like, you know, hundreds of them. And I love that they're all like easily unlockable in game and you don't have to buy extra DLC to get more. Which is like, wow, that's new in this modern era of video games that we live in.
I'm also a vindictive cuss and like the fact that they further solidified the blob feet canon.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, that's what they got. Neener, neener, neener.
And I also like how they gave ridiculous eye options. Like, oh, I don't know if we'd ever see, like, those are not eyes we'd ever see on, like, canon Sonic characters, but they gave them to the player characters. They have to know what they were doing with some of those eye options. They had to know. Like the weird dead eyes or the giant eyes that just look ridiculous. They had to know that they looked completely ridiculous. And, you know, props to them for throwing them in there and for, like, being like, yeah, sure, you can do that, whatever. We don't care. So, that's fun. But, yeah, other than that, I haven't played Sonic Forces yet, so I'll leave it at that.
I don't know. I think it's worth a playthrough. It's cheap. It's fun to just breeze through.
I'll get it.
Some of the tracks are fun.
I will get it eventually. I'm sure I will at some point. And, you know, give it a play. It doesn't look that bad. There was a lot of criticism of it when it came out. But, I mean, in terms of Sonic games, it looked okay. It looked fine. It looked okay. It wasn't a complete buggy mess. It wasn't totally unplayable. It was... The story was hilariously kind of, I don't know. It just, the story was a little like on the nose, shallow kind of, I guess. I don't know. It was silly. We've talked about that before, though. All right, and fun. Let's get into some standard Q&A. First up, we have one from Domus Caligari. I don't suppose there might be any Fleetway's Sonic the Comic love hidden in IDW's new Sonic run.
Maybe? Question mark? Not initially, because like I've said before, we're trying to define the book as the IDW Sonic. It needs to stand on its own 2 feet before we start going crazy with references to other incarnations of Sonic over the years. That and the last time there was any kind of Fleetway nod in the Archie book, it had some really nasty blowback, so might want to dodge that minefield. But I'm always tempted because Nigel Kitching said I could use Metallic, and I want to, but I know that it's more complicated than that, but I want to so bad.
All right, next one comes from the Zig PC. Something has been on my mind lately. Do you think the whole debacle with Ken Penders contributed to Archie and Sega not continuing their relationship? I understand that it was years later, but the ripple effect of the reboot must have hurt a lot.
No. It had no... It didn't help things, but it was not a major contributing factor. The reboot happened. It sucked at the time. But we were rolling full steam ahead, and just other stuff happened. And here we are.
Yeah. All right, and the last question comes from Steph Cube. Hello, just wanted to know...
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing? That's not part of the question. Just wanted to know if there's a possibility that a person outside the USA, maybe from Central or South America, could get to work in companies like IDW, maybe delivering the works online, or is it necessary to be in person and in the same country?
Well, I'm based out of Toronto, Canada, so... That set some precedence there. I know Raffinite will be doing some work for the IDW book, and she is in Brazil?
Yeah.
Pretty sure.
Somewhere
Brazil?
Around there. Yeah, South. I think pretty South America-ish, yeah.
I mean, the internet is a beautiful thing, and digital media is great because that makes it a whole lot easier. So I think the most complicated thing is figuring out billing
right
internationally. But I don't think there is anything on the books saying, you know, no one outside of the U.S. I'm not 100% sure because I'm not a representative of IDW. I do not have, you know, direct access to the thinking of the editorial staff. So don't take that 100%.
I know that IDW hires a lot of international creators. So...
Yeah, they do. Okay, then.
Yeah, they have some international creators on their existing books.
I mean, if you want to, try for it.
Yeah.
You know? Because if you don't get in, well, too bad. At least you tried. If you don't try, you never get in.
Exactly.
So it never hurts to try.
Right.
Unless it's tasting lava, and then that hurts the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. You may want to not do that. I mean, you could try. I can't guarantee it'll end well. How are you submitting stuff, Ian? I know things have changed since you first tried to break into the industry. I don't know if online submissions are generally accepted now, or if it's still better to actually mail in a portfolio or whatever.
It's been so long since I've had to actually try to kick down a door.
Right.
I've been in the industry so long, I actually have contacts, so I have some inside channels that I can use, which, let me tell you, is a lot easier.
Yeah.
But having a nice, succinct PDF or having a nice, simple portfolio website are really good ways to go. Because with a website, all that they have to do is click a link and browse through your material. And I don't mean, you know, showcase everything you ever have. And you don't even need a very complicated website, just something that shows off what you can do. I know there's a bajillion different ways that you can render Tumblr to show off your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want your own Tumblr account for your own thing, sure, you can make it for free, whatever. And then use one as your business portfolio Tumblr. It's free. Why not? Go for it.
Sure. You've also got cheap options like Squarespace, which is not a sponsor of the show, sadly, but they could be. You know, they have good options of being able to build a like a single page portfolio website, even just like, you know, scroll down and show off all your stuff without having to, you know, click links and all that crap. It's just all on one nice page that has all your contact info and has your works on it and all that good stuff. So there are a lot of options out there.
Yep. You're competing against a huge crowd of people. So just make sure that you're succinct, that you're showing off your best stuff, and that you're very easy to contact. That's the three key points.
Yep.
Hi, this is who I am. Look at all my cool stuff. Here's how you read. Boom, yep. Boom, boom.
And if you have industry contacts, you may want to try and leverage that.
Absolutely.
Yes. Networking is something I'm horrible at, but it's very important. So, all right. And that will do it for this edition of the Bumblecast. We got some outro stuff to get on with, though, first before we go. So.
And before we even get to that, we need to send out a big thank you to everyone who makes this show possible.
Of course.
So big shout out goes to Tick Tick, Daniel H, Propsham, Alex P, Fatoler, Scruffy Matt, Chris A, Damo, John B, Sam Cybercat, Mike B, Samuel P, Jennifer R, David C, Rebel Blight, Nyan W, Lisa M, Saturn Flicky, Justin S, Justin G, Connell T, Mike D, Adam T, Silly String, Carl, Michael A, Q, Artindy M, Lee H, K, Chevelle, Don B, Sin Fritz, A, E, Double, Taco El Gato Comics, John M, S, Yardovich 9X, James K, Papadipadropoulos,
Papadropoulos,
Overthinking Films, Adam BT, and Ron.
Is it Ron? It's Ron. Yay, it's Ron. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you all.
And everyone else, yes, of course. But, you know, we've talked about Ron multiple times. I can't keep talking about Ron. Thank you, everybody, for your support. It's great. It's glorious. And we have a lot of Justins, by which I mean we have two, and that's more than anybody else, name-wise. It's just like, wow, Justin G and Justin, what is it, T? I don't know.
G and S.
G and S, okay, yeah. Connell T, that's the one. Anyway, go ahead, Ian, sorry.
Where can the wonderful people find you after the show?
I'm going to be in bed. But
no, don't try to find, that's not the show we run here. Online, where can they find you online?
You find me on Twitter at KyleJCRB. I'm you're still able to get a hold of me there, even though I'm like not really actively using it, although you can still get KNGI updates as things get posted there, so you know it still has a use, and I'll reply to any notifications I get, so it's fine. You can also head on over to KNGI.org, and you can find Nitro Game Injection streaming live Saturdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Unfortunately, 8BitX is going to be closing up shop here, and will be going down for foreseeable future. So KNGI.org/listen is where you can find all the information to keep listening to NGI, because I'm still streaming. Still having a good time, so be sure to check it out, Saturday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And what about you, Ian?
You can find me at IanFlynnBKC or my website, BumbleKing.com.
Don't forget, you can also follow updates and ask us questions on Twitter at BumbleCast, or using the hashtag BumbleCast, or both, whichever, it doesn't really matter. And you can also email us at bumblecast@yahoo.com. You can email us your questions or your entries for Bumble Raffle and all that good stuff. So
one of these days when we have free time, we're going to be streaming again over at twitch.tv/bumblecastgaming.
Yeah,
you can catch.
We're going to do that. Go ahead.
I think I will. You can also catch archives of all of our gaming videos for Bumblecast Gaming over on youtube.com/bumblekingvideos.
Don't forget, you can also head on over to Patreon, patreon.com/bumblecast, where you can catch Bumblecast, where you can catch Patreon exclusive Bumblecast gaming live streams every Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern time. You can join in the chat and join in the fun during the live stream, and you know, have a good time hanging out with us.
You'll also get the exclusive first look at Bumble commentaries when we finally get that up.
Yeah. And don't forget, Bumble Store, you can find at shop.spreadshirt.com/Bumble Store. That's where you can get your Bumble gear, like your Bumble hats and your Bumble stickers. I don't know if they sell stickers or not, but maybe they should. I don't think
so, but you can get a Bumble phone case.
You can get a Bumble phone case? They have a Bumble phone case for my OnePlus 3. Probably not, because nobody does.
I don't know. They got a wide variety of them.
Probably not for a OnePlus 3, though. I mean, we get left out in the cold here. These poor OnePlus, poor OnePlus users. I guess that's what we get for using a phone that like nobody's heard of, but is a wonderful, delightful device. But that's okay. I'm not bitter. I'm actually not. I'm playing it up for the show.
Sure you are.
I like my case.
That's going to wrap us up for episode 65 of the Bumblecast, as Kyle mutters bitterly to himself with his tiny inserta. We will catch you in 2 weeks for Bumblecast episode 66. Everybody have a lovely evening.
My tiny what?
I'll give you a shiny nickel if you actually make that the intro.
I just might. Don't tempt me.
Hi there, and thanks for listening to the Bumblecast. If you liked our show, be sure to hit the subscribe button and consider supporting us on Patreon. We have some great rewards as well as big plans on how to make the show even better. Also, rate and review our show on iTunes. It gets more folks listening and helps us out, so we definitely appreciate it. Original music composed by Ken Coda Snyder, used with permission. Find more of his music at bc.s3m.us and find the theme song at noisechanradio.bandcamp.com, available as a pay what you want download.
Discord cut out. I actually didn't.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I actually didn't hear your tiny. And then it just like kind of cut out and then came back. You came back.
Yeah, phone.
It's just like that one word. My tiny
phone.
My tiny phone. It didn't cut out completely. It just kind of like glitched a little bit and kind of cut out ish. So it didn't sound like you said anything dirty. It just was like.
should we re-record that farewell then, just so there isn't that blip?
I don't know. I think it might be funnier this way.
All
right. That's fine. It doesn't sound horrible. I just made it horrible. that's what I do to everything. I make it horrible because it's fun.